the blood red. 'Cause I'm a bad man, I'm a bad man. Taking my time in the killing fields, ripping the cover from the cell and seal. Yeah, I'm a bad man.
Yeehaw, everybody. How's everybody doing? My name is Juan. This is the first anniversary of A Wanted Alive or Preferably Dead. With me, as always, is, you know, author, entrepreneur, you know, the best-looking man in West Virginia, Stephen Thompson. How are you?
Doing fine, my friend. How about yourself?
I'm doing okay, you know. I'm very excited that we actually hit a year.
Yeah, because we are normally suck at this. We are not known for our consistency.
No, not at all. And so to kind of commemorate that, we've already talked about Carbucci once this first year with the Hellbenders, but we decided to, as kind of like it's a year anniversary, it's also our 10th episode, that we will tackle two of his, you know, kind of seminal classics in the genre of spaghetti western, Django and The Great Silence. So we'll start with Django because it's just, you know, why not do a release order? So this was kind of a film. So Leone and Carbucci both got to see Yojimbo at the same time, right? And we'll probably tackle Fistful of Dollars at some point. But so both men saw it at the same time and they both loved the concept of the film. Which, if you've never seen Yojimbo, it's about a wandering samurai coming into a town and kind of playing the two adversaries against each other for the greater good. So both men took that concept. Leone pretty much straight up ripped it off and created A Fistful of Dollars and got sued by a Kurosawa and like his production company and everything.
Carbucci, if you watch those two movies, I mean, if you watch both those movies, it's like so freaking obvious. I mean,
it's night and day almost. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's some of the scenes are shot for shot. I mean, it's ridiculous how badly he ripped off Yojimbo.
It's just not expecting. Yeah. But like, that's kind of the Italian way, I guess you can say. They always, like, there's a ton of films where it's just like, hey, this film was popular in this country or here. And like, no one usually says anything. So we're practically going to take the whole film, change it up a bit, make it Italian, and then re-release it.
Yeah, you know? and they'll do that in, as long as it's bringing in a couple of dollars.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's, so that's been kind of the thing in, you know, spaghetti westerns and, you know, the Polizia films and then, you know, the apocalyptic films that, you know, Mad Max comes out. They made
all the Jaws ripoffs practically.
Yeah. It's kind of the bread and butter of the Italian film industry.
Yeah.
But the, which is kind of amazing looking over it, how many great directors come out of that, you know, with like Argento and Corbucci and Leone and the guy we love so much, Lucio Fulci.
Fulci?
Yes. I cannot think of his friggin' name.
Oh my God. I hear you. Like, and there's a ton of like plenty of scattered throughout the world of journeyman filmmakers in Italy that have been hoisted upon, like, here, this is a straight up rip off of an American film. Go and make whatever you want. And they make the most bizarre, crazy shit you can think of. So it's like, okay, so that was 64. So Carbucci had a couple of years to kind of like, and I guess really kind of, you know, work out his whole film. The great thing about this film is that it's was originally the concept of it is the stories by Carbucci and his brother Bruno. And then the screenplay is pretty much funny. Like everybody and their mother, even like Fernando De Leo pops up, like working on the screenplay at some point.
I think there's like six or seven people working on the script on this.
Yeah, along with Carbucci and Bruno and Sergio Carbucci, it's Francisco Rosati, Jose Gutierrez Massimo, and Pereiro Valoria, which, you know, totally nailed those. And then there's an English, because I was looking this up, that the, you know, I guess when they translated it, they actually gave credit to Jeffrey Copplestown, as the, you know, the American translator when they brought it here and, you know, dubbed it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, out of all of us, this is probably the first film that a lot of people saw, like starring Franco Nero, who a lot of people up until a certain period of time and we're still amazed that he was an Italian actor. He wasn't like a transplant, like a lot of, because a lot of American actors went to Italy to work in the, you know, the Westerns and stuff like that, because it was the, it was a well-paying gig and you weren't getting anything else but TV in America.
A lot of these movies starred either up-and-comers or on the downside of their fame.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Franco Nero was one that, you know, was Italian and, you know, came up in the system and actually became an international star because of Django. Yeah. And of course, and he's still working today.
Yeah, he's in the Pope's Exorcist. He's playing the Pope in the Pope's Exorcist, which is freaking bizarre. This is his like second year of being an actor. He started around 64, 65, still works to this day. And in the year of 1966, he works with Antonio Margheriti, Francisco Parspoli, Carbucci, Fulci, and Fernando Baldi, along with John Huston. Like, he made seven films in that year. It's like,
that's crazy.
And three films are pretty much classic Italian Westerns. You got Django, you got Massacre Time, the Fulci film, and you got Texas Adios, which is a really kind of unique kind of Italian yet kind of mired in the American ideas of Westerns, which is a really, really fun film, you just look at his whole filmography and you're like, holy shit, like this guy was really popular in his country. And a lot of the films he got made were pretty much based out to the, you know, the rest of the world, which is awesome. So it's like, it's kind of a small bit of it, because we're going to probably come back to Franco Nero, because he's in this year alone, he's in three really great Westerns. And he could continue to work in Westerns until pretty much that would die out. Now the kind of the rest of the cast is like, I really don't really need to, like, I know, like, I should be probably talking about like one or two other people. Especially like, was it Jose Baldano plays General Rodriguez, and Angela Alzeri, who plays Nathaniel, which is an interesting, he's an interesting character. He's kind of a character actor who pops up in a lot of stuff. I'm trying to figure out who else. What was the big badness? I can't remember his fucking name, you know. Major Jackson. So Elrado Fajardo. Yeah, that's the name. That's perfect one. he pops up in a lot of great stuff. And he was working from the 40s until in the early 90s. Not actually until 2002 when he, he's still alive, actually. He's 94. This is crazy.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, Gino Pernice, who plays, famously gets his ear cut off.
Yeah.
We talked about him a little bit when we were talking about the Hellbenders.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he had a very long and prolific career as well.
So kind of a quick on this story is, like, if you haven't seen, Akira Kurosawa's Yojimbo, it takes the same kind of concept, but works itself differently. You know what I mean? It's still a wandering gunman coming back to a town that he may or may not be involved in. At the start of the film, we see a bunch of Mexicans tie a woman to a cross, I guess you could say, and they start beating her mercifully with a whip. And he, you know, he's able to kind of, it's not him who stops it. It's the Red Brigade stops him. And then he decides to kill off the Red Brigade because ultimately they're going to bring him back to their men and kind of take their advantage on him. The woman named Maria. And it becomes this kind of power struggle between everybody. But it's unique because with Yojimbo, you know, Yojimbo, the character is playing off everyone else. It seems like Django is this kind of unworldly kind of superhero. You know what I mean?
In Fistful of Dollars and Yojimbo, the motivation is very clear. He comes into town, he finds out what the situation is, and he's like, okay, you've got them on one end, me on the end.
Yeah.
And the Rojos on one end, the Baxters on the other, and me in the middle. make mm-hmm. make a lot of money. And that's what he sets out to do. And his downfall is he lets his conscience get the better of him and, you know, rescues the girl that's been, you know, kidnapped.
Yeah.
And sets her free so that she can be reunited with her family. It's a very noble thing. The only noble thing he does in the movie.
Sure.
And for that, he gets his hands broken. And, you know, and then, of course, that sets up the finale.
Right.
Whereas in this movie, you're not really sure what Django's motivations are for quite a while through this movie.
Yeah.
You know, he's, you know, he comes into town. He has no interest in saving the girl. He only does it just, I mean, he lets the Mexicans beat the hell out of her. And then it's only after the, you know, the Colonel or Major Jackson's men come in mm-hmm. and kill the Mexicans that he decides to get involved and goes down there and blows away all the, all the white guys. And even then he has no interest whatsoever in getting involved with Maria.
No.
And then when he's in town, he kind of waits until he gets provoked by Jackson's men. He kills like five of them in one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah, that's a really
when he does that thing where like one guy's body, he just kind of like shoots over his shoulder and takes out five. I mean, it's just
in a row, just like, and not shoots anybody else. And they're all scattered in the room. And it's like, okay. So he has this kind of weird, like, magic to him. Like, he's this kind of mythical being within the, but he's fallible, which is great.
You find out the reason that he's there to kill Jackson.
Yeah.
He is there to fuck with Jackson because Jackson killed his wife, I guess, during the war because, mm-hmm. Django was off fighting for the North. And I guess in different translations of the script, you know, he may have been a deserter and in jail, and that's why he didn't make it back home.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, he was all fighting for the North, and Jackson is obviously, you know, he's
South because they're both still wearing their colors. So yes, you can definitely automatically tell just from, like, if you're a person who doesn't understand, if you're kind of trying to understand what's going on, you know, Django's still wearing his blue uniform, and all of the red coats, except for the hoods, are all wearing this kind of, you know, the uniform of the South.
Right.
So it's like, oh, okay. And the fact that, like, they're like, it's the secondary bad guys all wear red hoods around them. It's like, oh, okay. So they're Southern soldiers who wear hoods. Okay, we're just like, I know it's like, we're just tutting that in more and more that the American South is a bunch of racist bastards. No offense.
Yeah. I've heard three different explanations for that. One was that they didn't have enough extras.
Sure.
So if they covered up their faces, then they could die later on.
Yeah, six or seven times.
And then the other thing I heard was that a lot of them are really freaking ugly.
Well, when they show, like, there's that scene when they go into the bar and there's a bunch of the guys, a bunch of the Mexican guys, and you're like, and it's clearly like they're just, you know, they're browning them up. There's no, except for like our mad adversary, our main guy in that group. He's the only one who looks somewhat Mexican. And I know he's probably an Italian actor too. But it's like, yeah, these guys are a bunch of, and like, well, they're a bunch of rough looking guys, but then you get into the town, which the town is completely dead. And there's Nathaniel mentions that. He's like, this is a dead town. The only reason I get to survive is because we make a little bit of money and we keep Jackson off our back for protection. But like, even the women there are kind of rough. like we get that introduction where they're all standing around, like one's playing the piano and Nathaniel pulls out his fucking fiddle and he's playing the fiddle. And they're all just like, they look rough.
And not saying this to be mean, they're very average looking.
Yeah, well, they're average, and they're like
we're not talking about like the movie star looks like you've got with De Niro. Yeah, right. These are women that he probably looks like he picked them up off the street. And
two of them clearly have like their mustaches are growing in, and they're not completely taking well care of themselves. It seems like one of them may have like some kind of disease because she's constantly coughing. So it's like she has like kind of like either like, you know, some kind of not sexual disease, but like a normal kind of like, you know, generic like And it's just like, okay.
Yeah,
it's just like,
not healthy.
Yeah. Like the best looking one is the woman who kind of, I guess, runs the crowd. She's the one playing the piano and she's like, and it's like, I don't, you know, and then Maria comes in and they're like, oh, you know, like, hey, honey, you can work with us and you'll make plenty of money. It's like, not in this fucking company. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Maria, and this is something I don't know whether it just didn't register. Uh-huh. She's actually half Mexican, half white. And so that was like, I guess, an issue with Jackson or something. So Jackson kind of like was using her as property. And then she ran off to the Mexicans and they kind of made her property. Uh-huh. And so Django's the first person, even though he really doesn't want anything to do with her.
Yeah.
At least he didn't like, you know, he didn't want anything from her.
Yeah. He respects her and he's not using her as a pawn in between their little games, because you have the two warring factions, right? You have Jackson's men and you have the Mexicans, and they're both kind of using this woman as kind of like a weird pawn, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Like they keep dangling in each other's faces. Like, look, I have her now. Like, what are you going to do about it? You know, and it's like,
And Django is like really mean to her.
Yeah, there's scenes where it's just like, and you can tell that she's definitely has some kind of interest in him, maybe because she feels that he kind of has a respect for her, and she admires that. And there are just scenes where she'll come up to him to kind of like, you know, use him like as a, like, you know, protect me, and he just pretty much pushes her away. It's like bitch, I'm not fucking. That's not my job. Like, no.
Yeah, and you. It's never really clear whether he's trying to protect her, you know, by keeping her out of the situation because he's got his own plans, you know, mm-hmm. works, or if it's just he really doesn't care one way or the other. He's, you know, he's focused on his plan. So, you know, it's all the way through the movie, even to the last scene.
Yep.
Does he even give a shit about her? And, you know, I mean, and we'll get to that point in the plot, but.
Right. Yeah. So,
but it's a weird dynamic that, you know, isn't present in Yojimbo that I thought was interesting.
And the great thing is you get introduced to the town, you get introduced to the brothel, the women, and are Jackson automatically gets called because there is the preacher is kind of roaming around, who's also one of Jackson's men. And he goes over, you know, runs to Jackson and tell him that, oh, you know, Maria is in the brothel with this man. Maybe we should go and, you know, check it out, which is the great thing about being introduced to Jackson. He is pretty much pushing young Mexican men out of a cow's kind of cattle and having them run off into the hills and see how far they can get. And he's pretty much playing gun practice for them, where he's just pretty much shooting them dead as they make their way, and see how far he can get, how far they can get before he actually kills them.
There's this really darkly funny scene where, because Jackson, he'll get a couple hundred yards and pick him up with a rifle, and one of his sidekicks, Ringo.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, it's your turn, Ringo. And the Mexican gets like two steps outside the gate and he just starts filming.
He just stands up and the guy just shoots him dead. And then he's laughing and he's got a big fucking gun, like knife scar on his eye, like that goes down his whole cheek. And it's like, that's he's just laughing like a fucking lunatic and everybody else is laughing at it too. And it's like, okay, great guy. It's like, okay, this is a great group of guys I want to be affiliated with. All right. I can understand why Django has an issue with him.
And that guy, Ringo, one of the many things I've read over the years is that the reason he was given that name was because of the Ringo movies that came before. You know, it was a very handsome, heroic actor. And, you know, it was just a little jab by Corbucci saying, yeah, we're doing things differently.
I didn't even think of the last film that the last Western that Corbucci made was one of the Ringo ones. Like Ringo and his Gold Pistol or something like that. If he's working already in that thing, it's like it's a good kind of jab to people. It's like, hey, you've seen these films. I'm going to reference that character and kind of make him this kind of more rugged looking ugly fuck. And so they decide to go in and kind of investigate, you know, Jackson and his men. And, you know, another thing I forgot to tell you is that as when we start the film, we get this beautiful fucking song, which is probably one of the staples that has, I think, kind of pushes after this, the staple of the 5 minute introduction with the character name song playing at the beginning. You get a lot
throw the Jenga theme song in here somewhere.
So after the popularity of this film, because this film was very big.
30 times like I
you've done before. No, not doing that.
We're not doing that this time.
So you get this introduction of this even character.
That joke is so popular, somebody ripped it off on YouTube.
I know. So you get this song that kind of introduces you to the character and kind of explains a little bit of the storyline. While you watch this character walking, you know, with a saddle on his back and a coffin on a string, pretty much dragging both of them through the desert. And it's like, okay, sure. And you no one up until the point when, you know, Jackson's people show up, you're not sure what's in the coffin. And he keeps referencing that it's, you know, my friend isn't, you know, I'm burying Django. Da, da, da. Like he kind of plays the character off as he's, you know, he's another person who's taking care of business for this man. Right. And Django constantly makes references to burying off this version of himself, right, throughout the film.
And that's one of the things that, you know, I guess you kind of have to know what the costumes meant. But yeah. Like the big duster he's wearing, those are gravediggers and gloves. Those are gravediggers clothes.
Yeah.
They wear his overtops. And so you know, he's dragging a coffin. So it's one of those things. And it, like you said, it's referenced throughout when he's asked who's in the coffin. He says, it's a guy named Django. And then at the end of the movie, he's like, you know, I'm going to bury Django once and for all. He's got a coffin full of gold to deal with.
Yeah. And so Jackson's people come in, they kind of, you know, start their shit. And ultimately, Django is able to kind of take care of all of them. And the great thing is that Jackson and his men feel like an unmovable force. They feel like they've been in this town for a long period. The fact that they've kind of run everyone out but the brothel and the bar and the saloon, right? Because it's the one place where it's like they can continue to go and spend money and kind of, you know, why wouldn't they want to have a saloon with women in it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the rest of the town appears to be completely abandoned.
Yeah. They don't even have a mortuary or anybody to bury the dead in that town anymore, which is kind of like, if you read anything about the West, two of the things that always seem to stay put, well, three of the things, the bank, the Undertaker, and the saloon, as towns kind of changed and evolved and stuff like that. Because those are the three big businesses that always kind of survived in the West. Everybody needed to drink. Everybody needed to, you know, put their money somewhere, and everybody needed to bury somebody. So I was like, okay. So when you have a town that's that dead, and another thing I read about this film was that Carbucci originally wanted to do a film in the snow, and his producer was like, no, we can't do that. No yeah, way.
Exactly.
He's like, okay, well, what about the mud? And they're like, sure. So the whole town is covered in metal. Like it rained for like a month before Django got there, and the roads are just covered in mud, and people are constantly just kind of digging their feet in and out of mud throughout the whole fucking movie.
There's even a mud wrestling scene between two of the prostitutes. I mean, they get in a fight over some silly shit. I think three of them get involved in it, but
yeah.
And what's funny, if you look real close, you can see that they're stuntmen in dresses.
Yeah.
it's really weird, but. It's a muddy ass town, and oddly enough, it was designed based on the town in Shane.
Okay.
Which, again, it's another one of those things Corbucci seems to do. Like, you know, every movie we've talked about with Corbucci, it's always he's taking tropes and twisting them into his own vision of, you know, the way he thinks things should be.
Right.
And so it's like an Easter egg hunt throughout his movies. I know where that's from. That's from Shane. This is from, I can't remember which movie. It might have been a Bava movie that he took the red hoods from.
Yeah. Some people reference this.
Like Black, was which one had Karloff? Black Sunday, Black Sabbath?
Yeah, Black Sabbath, yeah.
Yeah, Black Sabbath, when we start talking about, he drew a lot of inspiration from Black Sabbath for Il Grande Silenzio.
Yeah. So, and a lot of people kind of reference this film as like a Grand Guignol, I guess you can say, because it has those kind of references to it. It has a supernatural power, because Django at times has this weird supernatural ability to kind of kill people with one bullet. The fact that when we get
at one point, he fires seven shots out of his six shooter.
Let's go back to something real quick. When you get to Jackson comes in and kind of starts shit with him, and they want to know what's in the coffin. He's like, all right, I'll go outside, I'll show you, pretty much. And you think that Jackson is going to be this big adversary. He's going to be this big kind of looming presence throughout the film, right? But what we find out is that in the coffin is a Gatling gun, which is, it isn't, the way he carries it around is just, it's infeasible. And this is another kind of thing that where it's like they miss this kind of like magic kind of entity that he is, because he's able to kind of just pick up a hot Gatling gun and kill 35 guys with it.
Yeah. It's one of the strangest props I've ever seen, because there's no trigger on the gun.
Yeah, there's a handle in the back. Yeah, it's pretty much like he took it off a mount, like a rolling mount, like you would see in the Civil War, and he's just and it's not mounted to anything else. He just pulls it out, and it's still got the mount on the bottom, and it's got the handle where it should be able to just shoot, But he picks it up like a hip slung like rifle, and just starts just gunning everybody down.
Yeah, it's got like 20 barrels, and they fire it kind of like a random order.
Yeah,
it's a bizarre prop, but it's effective, because he takes out 47 people in that scene. Yeah, Jackson said he had 48 men, and I think Jackson and one other get away.
Yeah,
maybe two. But he wipes out at least 40 people. That's amazing.
Yeah, and Jackson kind of retreats, because he's realized he's kind of licked, and he kind of goes, pretty much goes back, and we don't see him for the rest of the film. It's kind of a weirdly episodic film too, because we get this bad guy. He's able to massacre most of his crew, and then he disappears, and then the Mexicans come in, and we find, and there's a whole nother story going on with the Mexicans.
Right. You find out that Django and Hugo, is that the name of the Mexican?
Oh God, no, look!
I can't believe I forgot that too. Whatever, the main Mexican guy was
in prison. Hugo Rodriguez, General Rodriguez. Yeah,
Hugo was in jail with Django at some point.
Yep.
And the reason that Django let Jackson escape after he murdered all of his other men was because Jackson's gold is at this fort.
Yeah.
So he's going to recruit the Mexicans and says, look, you see this cool Gatling gun I've got? We can steal that gold. You can get 10 of these, and then you can go back to Mexico and wage your war the same way. I killed 50 people in the street. You'll have 10 of them. You can wipe out an entire army, you and your men.
Yeah. And ultimately, Hugo's kind of thing is he wants to get Jackson. Not even just get the gold. He wants to ruin Jackson. And this is where he's going back into Mexico to fight. It's because he's going back to fight. To get back into Mexico, he has to fight Jackson to do it. And you're like, okay. So, like, you know, and the only reason Hugo knows him because of jail. Django saved Hugo from jail, from an issue in jail. Saved his life. So he's indebted to him. So he sees this weapon. He goes, oh, we could use that. He's like, all right, well, if we steal this gold, I can get you 9 more of them. You could take this one and have 10 and go off and do whatever the hell you want, as long as I get a portion of the gold that you're agreeing upon. And Hugo says, sure, let's do it. So they do the whole big run. They get into this
the fort with the soldiers.
Yeah, they get into the fort. They're able to take everything out. They steal a good portion of the gold, and then Hugo kind of reneges on the whole thing. Says, "Why would you want to leave? Like, says, why don't you hang out with us? You're such a good. He's a good kind of like addition to his overall men. Because his men are kind of shit heels, I guess you can say. Like, yeah, they're constantly, because they're Mexicans, they see some of them have a chip on their shoulder and they want to start with Django. And Django's not a guy who wants to take shit. And he's just kind of like, he puts a couple of these guys in their place. And they're all kind of like, and another thing is that Maria was Hugo's kind of like collateral for a while. And then he kind of, like, I guess got sick of her, and he gave it to her, to his men, and that's where we find her at the beginning, where she's getting whipped, you know, almost to death by a bunch of Hugo's men. And it's like, you know, and Hugo's very happy that Django is able to bring back his collateral to him. But, like, you know, this is where the thing starts to change. Django starts to realize that he's not going to get what he needs from Hugo, even though he's kind of repaid his debt.
Yeah, he actually saves Hugo's life the second time during the raid.
Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, he's not an honorable guy. He's just a fucking prick like all the rest of these guys with power are. And so Django has to kind of take, you know, matters in his own hands. And for some strange reason, Maria wants to tag along, which Django doesn't particularly need at the time. And, you know, he ends up, and like what they steal is, they don't even steal, like what you expect in the Western is, like, they stole this big bag of gold, and when they empty out the gold into this, like, you know, the basement of the building, they think it's, you think it's gonna be like just gold, you know, gold coins and whatnot.
It's just raw gold.
It's mined gold. It's all gold pieces and small bits and whatnot. And it'll probably be a ton of money if when they go and mill it in to a bank or whatnot. But like right now it's kind of just, you know, gold bits and dust. Mm-hmm. But Django's entitled to a portion of it because he did put this whole goddamn plan together. So one night while they're all kind of fucking around at the bar, he decides to diverge get his gold back by using the gun as kind of a tactic. So he kind of mounts the gun in the basement, and it's just, you know, starts shooting off. Like, well, actually, he uses one of the girls. He uses one of the prettier girls. Like, kind of, and this is where one of the many things with him and Maria is, where they go, you know, Hugo says, "Hey, you can have Maria. She's yours now." And he goes, "No, I don't want her. Like, ugh, I don't want her." And yeah, I'll take the other one. And all the guys are like, "Look, Maria, you suck." Like, even the white guy doesn't want you. And it's like, so like he takes her to the place where the gold is, pretty much in the same area. I don't even know why they're not really paying attention. But these guys are such leches, they don't give a shit. They're more paying attention to the girl getting undressed in the window, and not really worried that Django is going to run with the gold, which we've already kind of established that Django wants his portion of the gold. He is very adamant about it. He's like, "Just give me my gold and I'll be off on my way. I don't need any more fucking problems. I know what you guys have, what the plan you guys have. But the amount of gold that you're taking, like, I'm always taking a small bit of it. It's not like I'm taking a shitload of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can go do what you want to do." And these guys rather just fucking fuck around, wait, I guess, until they get good and ready to do their shit. And Django's not wanting to wait. He's just like, "I want to get my gold and get out."
So yeah, this is one of the things that I didn't understand. I mean, I guess he kind of figured, okay, they're going to double cross me, so I'm going to double cross them before they get the chance.
Yep.
Why he got greedy and stole all the gold?
I don't know.
Instead of just taking his share and leaving, he probably would have been all right.
And it doesn't even really explain that at the end of the film when he's like trying to, like, you have that whole analogy where he's like, "I got to cross this bridge on my own." And it's literally a bridge over, quicksand. And you're like, okay, that's good writing, I guess.
Good on the nose.
It's like, shit.
Nice metaphor.
Yeah, it's, you know, the thing is, this film has got so much going on with it. Like, there's so many little weird kind of, like, tacks on, like, other Italian Westerns and the fact that it's a straight kind of, I guess you could say, clone of Yojimbo. It's not as, that is wild. It's much more wild because, like I said, you don't have both bad guys going against each other and Django kind of being the middleman who's kind of working both angles. He eliminates the first bad guy to give him enough time to, you know, get what he needs from the second bad guy. Mm-hmm. And then when Jackson comes back later in the film, you're like, oh, okay. And it's like, it makes sense that he would come back. And it's like, And it's just like you said, our hero gets too greedy. And he, you know, instead of taking just a small portion of the money he's supposed to entitled to, he takes all of it.
Yeah, he loads it all in the coffin, which more symbolism there.
Yeah, and he gets greedy and kind of sell, and he gets really kind of like lost in the whole cause of the whole thing. Maria kind of runs off with him because Maria wants to be with him because Maria has a respect for him because ultimately Django's the first man to actually treat her with some kind of dignity and respect. But he still has no use for her. He's like, I don't need you. Like, I don't want, like, I need the gold. I want to get my revenge and finish off this whole kind of story within my life and kind of go and be myself and go do something again and kind of kill that portion off and let that portion of my life die with my wife and kind of just be, and then be able to start my life over again. Right. Yeah.
Just real quick, going back to Maria, when he's stealing the gold.
Yeah.
He actually saves his life, and it's a kind of a reference to High Noon.
Yeah,
it's another one of those where Corbucci's taking the scene from High Noon, and played it. Except this time, she not only does she take out the one guy, then she takes out two more head on. So it's not just like she's keeping him from getting shot in the back. She then actively participates in the escape.
Yeah.
So it's, again, just taking a trope from a classic and then, just amping it up a little bit.
So, like, I know the ending, like, we can just talking to the ending. I mean, people who are listening to the show probably already watched this movie as many times as we have.
I hope so. And if they haven't, then
the ending, I think, is.
Or if you're like Wolford and don't even know who the fuck Franco Nero is, seriously, you've never seen Die Hard 2?
Yeah, but like the end of the film is this kind of it's this ultimate we're gonna completely kill. And the one thing I love about this is like this film was so popular that like. I was just saying this to my girlfriend. This film was so popular in Germany that every film after this Nero made had the word Django put into the title, right? Like they just went bizarre with it to the point of I don't think it's nowadays, but I think 60s and 70s at least, every film he made, regardless of what it was, it could have been a romance film, an action film, crime film. Django was in the title, like it was
whatever. Yeah, and I made a joke about The Last Shark is that the name of the movie?
The Shark Hunter is that? I think that's what you're talking about, though. The Shark Hunter one.
Yeah, the Jaws ripoff, that he was in, I made a joke about that was like Django versus Jaws in Germany.
Yeah, yeah.
And it turns out it was like Django Shark Hunter or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
I was like, seriously? It's like,
Jesus. But like,
they love them some Franco Nero.
Yeah. And like the fact that this film was like banned in the UK up until like 93 or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Because of its violence and the reviews for it originally were very negative because of the inherent violence in the whole film. But if you look at the film, like the film is a very violent film, right? For very much for the time period of Westerns in general.
You've got a guy being force fed his own ear, the most famous violent scene.
Right.
And there is a lot of blood, but it's not like even as graphic.
Well, even like
something is a Wild Bunch or something, but right. Body count is freaking outrageous. Uh-huh. Yeah. Body count's got to be in the 150 to 200 range.
Yeah. And then you get the whole scene at the end where when Django gets his hands crushed, and he has to force to defend himself and he has to pretty much tear his gun apart with his mouth. To kind of try to defend himself in this old graveyard near the town. And it's just a wild film. Like, I mean, I'm amazed that something like this got made and the Italians are always kind of known for kind of like taking the, the shit with it. They're like, you know what? This is a big, this, anything that was popular. So when comedy started getting popular in the '60s, they ran with comedies and they ran with teen comedies because, you know, Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin were big people in the '50s and early '60s. So when they came to Italy, they were like, all right, we got to get like any kind of two person kind of team together and make millions of films with them.
Yeah. Which right? is, yeah, which is one of the reasons we got Terrence Hill and Bud Spencer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, so when the Westerns came, the Western, they had, you can definitely tell between the strict Italian Westerns and the ones that kind of take, like, Texas Adios is a Western directed by an Italian, but it has very much tropings of an American Western. This mm-hmm. film has its own kind of, you know, way of looking at it. And the fact that this film became so popular, it became kind of this high grade for a lot of other directors who were making Westerns at the time to kind of ape that film. Not the story per se, but like ape the violence and ape the kind of protagonist style. Cause we would have a lot of films after this where it was a, you know, a man with no name style character, even though a lot of people say like Leone's films also helped with that, which they did. When you have a character that comes into town, it's like Rango, Sabata, Sartana, it's like fucking, you know, every goddamn thing in the world. Just with these one name characters coming in and kind of, you know, cleaning up the town, but in the most violent ways. It's that's where the Italians and Americans kind of, and then you get guys later in the genre, like, Peckinpah and whatnot, who would take that Italian kind of violence and do it to the nth degree, with his films. But it's like, I don't know, like I'm amazed when I was going through stuff and reading essays about this film and how when it originally came out, it was popular and it did make money, but it was kind of slayed by the critics. And like, it got a ban in the UK when it made its way to the United Kingdom. And the Americans were kind of like iffy on it because it was such a violent film for the '60s because it was still that time period, you know, ultra violence wasn't a big thing. It didn't start really until like a couple years later, in America anyway. And it's like, it's such a wild take compared to like what Leone was doing with the Fistful of Dollars film. And it's like, you can definitely tell, you can tell with Carbucci, it's like, he was a man of the people. He didn't, a lot of those like workmen, you know, kind of journeyman Italian filmmakers were like that. They're very kind of like blue collar, you know, salt of the earth kind of guys. And they kind of showed it in their work. Right. And Carbucci was one of those guys who kind of took it to the nth degree. He kind of was like, this is who I am. It's pretty much on the page. The character, you know, the main characters in these Westerns are a kind of an allegory of his like principles and ideas. And like a lot of the writing in there is taken on that. It's anti-establishment.
Yeah. He's very like Fulci is anti-church, yeah. anti, mm-hmm. you know, fascist. Mm-hmm. Very, very, he's very left-wing guy.
Yeah. So it's just that you can just tell in this film, like, and he, and Carbucci had been making films for years prior to this. There's a great documentary, like a documentary from the time period, that was clearly done by Italians, and then they dubbed it into English, and I guess they showed it. It's like a 30-minute documentary about the Western, you know, spaghetti Western craze and coming to America. And there's a small interview with Carbucci in there, and he goes, you know, I make films. Like, I don't, like, there's no, he's like, I don't particularly like making Westerns. When I make Westerns, I like to make movies. And the interviewer says, what is your next movie? He's like, well, you don't like making Westerns. What's the next thing you're going to make? He's like, it's probably Western. And he just laughs. Yeah, like, as a response. And it's like,
yeah, that's great.
It's like, it's perfect. Cause it's like, cause that's the guy he was. He liked working in the film industry, but like a lot of Italian directors, they didn't really have a say. Like, it's like the thing is, like, American directors had more free will to kind of pick and choose what they wanted. When you look at other countries like Italy or Japan, they were kind of like, they worked for whatever film company they worked for. You know, mm-hmm. they didn't dive all over the place. They worked for like whatever this, you know, whatever film production company they were kind of hired there, and they were salaried. And like, they just kind of, okay, you make four films a year. This is what you're making. You know, we'll let you make the screenplays. We'll let you do everything to it, but you're not.
You're going to do what's trending.
yeah, you're going to do whatever the hell is making the money. And that's the same thing with the Japanese. The Japanese filmmakers were kind of like, you know, they were paid by the studios to make, continue making films, you know, and they couldn't veer out of whatever the studio had, you know, whatever the studio idea was, whatever like the style was or anything like that. At least with the Italians, they were able to kind of like branch out. Like they can write the screenplays, they can shoot the films, and then they can pretty much like massively like massage them into their, into like a piece of art that, you know, fully shows their, like, you know, the way they live, the way they think in film.
Right.
Right. So I don't know. I think I know we both like this film. I know we've both seen this a number of times over the years, and it's something that we kind of, like, I go back to, I know you probably do too, because it's just, I don't know.
Oh yeah. It's for a movie that is as bleak as it is. Mm-hmm. It's still very, I mean, there's plenty of action in it. Yeah. There's that dark humor there. There's a lot there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on that we're not going to find in the next movie, which makes it much more depressing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's for all of its, you know, darkness and, you know, downer kind of tone, it's still, you know, it's still very much a fun. There's a lot of fun to be had with this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, despite the, you know, the darkness that's in it.
Right.
And so, you know, like I said, there's action. There, you know, there's big set pieces like the attack on the fort and the big gunfights in the middle of the streets. And there's a bar brawl between Django and one of the Mexicans. You know, it's got, like I said, it's got all the tropes that you kind of expect, and it's got the action set pieces.
All right.
But at the same time, it's got the, you know, the kind of darker anti-cap. Political statement, anti-greed thing.
Definitely. You
know, everything goes to shit for everyone.
Uh-huh.
And Django, like I said, you really don't grapple with the relationship between him and Maria.
Yeah.
Because when he's getting, you know, when he's, after he's stolen the gold and rescued her, and let her come along, once they get to that point where it's like, okay, you can go the hell on. I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to go start my life over. There's no place for you.
Yeah, literally, I have to cross a bridge, which when he shoots this scene, there's this rickety bridge that's over this kind of quicksand, kind of like, I guess, like dried up gulch. And you're like, okay, like I get it. Like he's got to cross the bridge. And it's like, wait to beat it into our heads there, Corbucci. It's like, and then, yeah, he's like, thank you for helping me, but I don't need you just to stay with me. And then like, you have this whole kind of like happenings where they kind of get into a little bit of scuffle, and the coffin filled with gold, like soon slides down the hill into the quicksand, and greedily, you know, Django goes to try to save it and almost drowns himself. And it takes Burita to kind of help him pull him out. Because he almost dies trying to save the coffin, but the coffin's, you know, a wooden coffin with, like, you know, a couple, you know, pounds of gold in it. And you have also Hugo's men kind of charging after them, kind of trying to get him back.
Yeah, and Maria gets shot.
Yeah,
and I mean she doesn't die. At least I guess she's still alive in kind the future. Of. In the future, but she's on her deathbed.
Right.
And then all of a sudden Django has this change of heart where it's like, okay, well, I guess we can start a life together now that I don't have any other options.
Yeah.
It's like, really? So, I mean, so yeah, it's still after all these years, I don't know.
Yeah.
How well that relationship was going to, you know, work out once the movie was, you know, the curtain comes up.
Yeah, and like one of the things I never noticed until now, I don't know, maybe this is out of my mind when I was watching it yesterday, was that like Nathaniel, like, you know, he's pretty much like, you know, you have the whole thing, there's that mud wrestling scene with the girls because they kind of get a little greedy with each other. But then like at the end of the film, you see Nathaniel actually finally give up on the town. And he's walking out with one of the paintings, I guess one of the more valuable paintings, or maybe it's a family heirloom or something like that, and like his fiddle case. and he's just leaving town because there's no reason for him to be there anymore. Like, they're barely, when we start the film, he's barely making any money. I think he had like a couple of dollars and a couple of bits of change to give the Jackson, and Jackson's like, oh, you can keep it. Like, it's pissant, so I don't need it.
Yeah, but I'm coming back next week and you better have my money.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I mean, all the money he was making whoring those girls out.
Yeah.
He was paying right back to Jackson for protection. Yeah. So right. Like, nobody's
winning at all. So yeah, Nathaniel finally gives up on the town. He's leaving. And you're like, it's like, oh, okay. And it's like the saddest thing I ever see, where you see this man walking out of town with a painting and his fiddle case. And he's got nowhere else to go. And it's like, Jesus Christ. It's like, you know, at some point when, like, all the bullshit is cleared out, when you have no bullies roaming around anymore, because, you know, Jackson's going to have nobody to, you know, push around anymore. So he's going to go to the next town and see what he can do. Mm-hmm. So at some point, somebody will find this abandoned town and reestablish it. But it's like, Jesus. Like, and it's very rare that you see a town, you see a Western where the town is completely vacant. Right.
Yeah.
There's always people, even if the town is being run by one ruthless guy, there's always people still living in the town that have kind of gotten used to this ruthless fuck, you know, pretty much forcing all of them to pay, you know, loyalty money or protection money or something like that. And everybody else has kind of gotten used to it. And it's just a strange kind of concept that, like, the town is practically 99.9% dead except for this brothel in the middle of town. And you're like, okay. It's just like, holy shit. And like, yeah, like, you get like his penance at the end with, you know, when he gets his hands crushed by Hugo, and then he has to kind of fight, you know, try to survive. And it's just like, it's one of those kind of things. And like, I think this is the first film I ever saw where I was like, I really was kind of turned on by the whole like nihilistic ending.
Mm-hmm.
Of like, you know, the hero doesn't win, you know, he loses at the end of the thing. Cause I think I saw this and Silence pretty much in the same couple of weeks when I first saw them. And I was like, oh my God. And it ultimately made me go, I love this fucking director. Like, these two films are, and they're fairly different, but they both have the same kind of nihilist ideals to them. And it's like, just, it's just brutal way to end the film. And it's like, I can understand why the critics were like, yeah, this is way too much. It's like, okay, sure. Like, yeah, the guy who's going through the penance gets his ultimate, you know, comeuppance and doesn't get a resolution, doesn't get the revenge, doesn't get the girl, you know what I mean? So to speak. He gets, you know, what happens when you kind of go to the extreme, when you get too greedy, trying to get rid of something you think you need to get rid of. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. You've got a hero that, you know, and, you know, that's not going to happen in American Western. The hero is not going to, you know, succumb to greed. He's not going to, you know, lose it all at the end.
No.
But, you know, and the only thing that, and that's the thing, nobody survives this movie. Maybe Maria survives her gunshot wound. We don't know. Mm-hmm. And Django is basically the only one left, and his hands are all crushed. I mean, nobody has a good end, and he went all through all this shit. Yeah, he got Jackson eventually, but, you know, the price he had to pay for it all, he, you know, all of it was for nothing. And it's just freaking depressing, actually. but like you said, you know, that ending is so great because you don't know how the hell he's going to get out of it. He's got five guys coming after him. Jackson's one of them, and you know Jackson's a hell of a shot. And yeah. And he has basically no hands and six bullets. That's uh-huh. And it's just, okay, how the hell is he going to pull this off? And it's a pretty cool resolution.
Yeah.
And I wish that they would have kept the Italian ending for this, because I guess where Jackson was a kind of like a religious nut, you know, uh-huh. he was doing God's work by eliminating the brown people because, you know, but
racist.
Yes. Yeah. They think they're, yeah.
Nobody, they think God wants them to kill the same people that his color of skin was, you know.
Dumbasses. But yeah, and the line is like he's like firing shots at, because Jango's hiding behind a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And he like puts a bullet in the cross, and he's like kind of doing like the well, you can't see me because my camera's not working, but he does like he fires like three shots, the Father, Son, the Holy Ghost, and then Jango says amen and blows the shit out of him. And this is like, man, that would, I wish they would have kept that in the English for dub.
Yeah, that
that's
been nice.
Such a cool ending. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just a great movie, and you know, there's a reason why, you know, that name keeps coming up over and over and over again. You know,
definitely.
Django and Chain, Sukiyaki Western Django, mm-hmm. 500 other freaking Django movies.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's a great movie. Mm-hmm. And I guess one thing, one little bit of trivia I thought was interesting was it was Ruggiero Deodato.
Yeah, he was the assistant director, right?
Who convinced Corbucci that Franco Nero was the guy for the part. And I was like, wow, that's pretty good. And then dude went on to make, of course, you know, Cannibal Holocaust.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So like when I think it was one of the first films
he just died last year.
Yeah, he did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was it December last year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Man, he's been around for a while.
Yeah. So continuing with this is that, so Corbucci kind of, you know, I think this film was like, this year he made like around four films. He made Ringo and His Golden Pistol. He made the Navajo Joe film with Burt Reynolds, which I haven't seen. I do want to see. I hear it's kind of the whole mix of like, you know, a lot of people think it's really crappy. A lot of people didn't like, a lot of people like it. And I think like Burt Reynolds was kind of like iffy on that whole, on that film. I think he didn't really care for it.
He didn't like Corbucci.
Yeah.
And Corbucci, well, because he thought he was going to get to work with the other Sergio Leone. He thought he was going to work for Sergio Leone.
Typical, yeah.
And Corbucci, for some reason, thought he was getting Marlon Brando instead of Burt Reynolds.
Wow. Like,
so neither one of them were happy from the beginning when it came to Navajo Joe. So.
Right, and we already talked about the Hellbenders. And then there was a spy film he did called Death on the Run, which came out that same year, The Hellbenders. So to start off 1968, he goes and does The Great Silence, which the kind of the stories I remember reading was that like Jean-Louis Trintignant, yeah, was because he was kind of a well-known French actor. He felt that the Westerns was like a put down to him, right? And this is the old wives tale I heard. And then as years have gone by, that's kind of changed in a weird way. But do you have anything about that?
Well, because he had gotten a lot of notoriety because one of the movies he did was that In God Created Woman with Brigitte Bardot.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there were some kind of rumors going around that the two of them were an item.
Yeah.
And of course, if everybody thinks you're dating Brigitte Bardot, that kind of elevates your name.
Uh-huh.
So he was kind of not so much because of his acting, but his notoriety because of that led to more jobs.
Yeah.
And so it was one of those things where, okay, you know, by 68, there were hits
with
the spaghetti westerns. You know, by then Leone stuff had hit America.
Yeah,
because it hit about the same time Django was coming out in Europe,
right?
And then, of course, you know, Django was huge in Europe, so it was one of those things where, okay, you know, I guess I'll give this a shot.
Uh-huh.
But when they were going to make the movie, they wanted people that could speak English, and Trintignant could not.
Yeah.
So,
but it was a face and a name that people knew, right? Yeah. From the European art house, like film scene.
Yeah, and what's funny is, you know, he played the character mute. You know, the character cannot speak.
Yeah.
His name is Silence. The only other thing I remember seeing him in, well, the movie that I've seen with him in it is The City of Lost Children, which is a wild movie, but he's a voice actor in it.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, so the one movie I've seen him in, he doesn't speak at all. And the other one, he doesn't appear at all. So that's Stephen trivia when it comes to Jean-Louis Trintignant.
So I always heard that story about Trintignant kind of like being this prima donna going, I don't want to be in this Western. I'll only be in this Western if you make my character silent. And then I've read and I watched a couple of interviews with Alex Cox, who is a huge Spaghetti Westerns fan.
Oh, yeah.
And who's written written one really great book called
10,000 Ways to Die. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a fantastic book on the Spaghetti Westerns. And he said that he had actually talked to Trintignant when, he was still alive, when like Cox was making films in the '80s. And then he actually said that when he was introduced to Corbucci, he kind of read the screenplay and said, wouldn't it work a little better if I didn't have any lines at all? Cause like he was worried that because he was French, and because, it was kind of a weird cast. Another thing, if you don't know with Italian film in general in the time period, and Corbucci was kind of known for this. Corbucci was known for, because it didn't really matter what they said. Like
he would just have them count. So their lips,
he would count them 1 to 10 while their lips were moving. And he would just, because it was always going to be dubbed regardless, because they didn't do sync sound when they were shooting, because it was cheaper not to shoot sound when they were shooting the films. That Trintignant was kind of worried that people would, because he's French, they would just find it off-putting that he could have like an English accent in the film. So he suggested to Corbucci to kind of just write all the stuff that he's supposed to write, all he's supposed to say, and just kind of eliminate it and just make his character silent. And kind of Corbucci kind of, mulled it over for a little while. And ultimately, because he had the actor he had to deal with, he decided to go for it. And kind of give a couple other characters a little more room to kind of breathe, which it kind of works in the long run. And we get like this, we get one of the more, next to like, Django and like, the characters that, Clint Eastwood would play for Leone in the Dollar Trilogy, kind of the middle guy, I guess you can say, in that kind of Mount Rushmore of great Italian characters. Trintignant plays a character named Silence. And then you have Klaus Kinski, who, will be a guy who will pop up a couple more times on this show, because he was known to make a ton of spaghetti westerns as well. German.
And also he's batshit crazy. So he's always fun to talk about.
Right. And he plays our main bad guy. Was it Lobo?
Loco.
Loco. And then you have guys like Frank Wolf, it's just, one of those kind of actors who sadly didn't, like, he sadly killed himself in the early 70s. But he was in a bunch of really cool films. He's in Once Upon a Time in the West. He's in this. He's in Atlas. Death Walks in High Heels is really cool, kind of like a gialli. He's kind of our, he's a lot like I watched this version because so if you need to see these films, to be honest, you can see them anywhere. Like every streaming service has them practically. Django's released. Yeah, they're on YouTube in decent quality. Django was released through Arrow on a really great Blu-ray release. And then they actually just released it, I think, last year on 4K. Silence finally got like a really great release a couple of years ago through the company Film Movement, which kind of does like a lot of art house stuff. And they did a really great release of that film. And also I think you can pretty much rent it from any kind of streaming service, Amazon, Vudu, whatever, YouTube if you want. I think there is a YouTube version of it roaming online, for free.
On YouTube you could, there's the Italian dub and the English dub are both there if you want to check them out. Yeah. Frank Wolf was one of those guys that like he showed up on TV shows like Rawhide and Twilight Zone. He did some Roger Corman flicks.
Yep.
And like we said earlier, a lot of American actors that couldn't kind of make their big break in Hollywood would come over. And he's one of those guys, and he had a fairly successful career. And like you said, he was, Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah, good amount of films in general. Sadly, he wouldn't be, a couple years after this, he would have taken his life. Also, we have Valletta McGee, who is our kind of main female lead in the film. A lot of people who are listening to this, if you have never watched Silence, you'd probably know her from Repo Man, Alex Cox's film, from a number of years later. And the reason why she's in that film is because Cox had seen the Great Silence and wanted to work with her, like, in the worst fucking way. I knew she was an American actress and stuff like that, so kind of went out and found her, like, for his first American film.
She did what, Shaft in Africa, and she did some of the blaxploitation movies when she came back to America.
Yep.
And then the other name that you'll see, I'm sure we will talk about many times, Luigi Pastilli.
Yep.
He was in, which ones were, he worked with Leone, was A Few Dollars More and Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah.
I mean, he did a shit ton of these movies too. And he had a very long, prolific career.
Yeah.
And Trenton Yawn, speaking of people that died last year, he died last year at the age of 91.
Yeah.
And he worked his entire life. He is up until, like, I guess he got cancer in 2017.
Yeah.
And decided not to seek treatment because he's, 80 some years old.
Mm-hmm.
But he kept working, and his last movie comes out next year.
Jesus.
So he had to, I guess, pray COVID interrupted his career.
Probably. Yeah, yeah.
which is so weird to say. Yeah, COVID interrupted the 90-year-old man's career.
Yeah.
But he did a ton of stuff, just amazingly prolific career.
So, like what I was saying with Frank Wolf's character, like, originally people kind of write him off as kind of like a comedy character, and there are funny moments. His character is kind of meant to lighten the mood a little bit, I guess you can say, because the film is rather bleak. So what you have here is it's Mormon settlers, right? That's what's going on. So you have
It takes place in Utah, and we know nothing good comes from Utah.
Yeah, Utah and the snow,
especially the corpse cast.
So this is Carbucci finally gets his way after kind of working for a number of years trying to do things. He finally gets his way with the film. What he wants to do is he wants to make a film on the snow, and predominantly this film for the first 40 minutes of it is done in the hills, in America, like in the snow. Deep snow, no less.
Like up to the horse's belly snow in some of the scenes.
There's that great scene where, like, Frank Wolf's character is coming into town, like he's making his way to town, and the horse is just giving up because he can't get through this fucking snow anymore. And you have the Mormon settlers kind of like bombard him, and they're like, "We don't want to hurt you. We just want your horse." And he's like, "What can you do with one fucking horse?" And he's like, "We can eat for weeks." It's like,
yeah.
Oh. Like they scare him off, right? But
come to think of it, I don't know if they are Mormons. I know that, I mean, they are in Utah, but
yeah, that's what I always thought. They don't really specify, but they are settlers, and they're pretty much being run out of their homes and whatnot by the bank, as like illegal payment, I guess you could say. They haven't paid their loans off and shit like that. So the bank is a greedy fuck.
Pastilli's character, his name's Polycut, and I guess if we ever get around to the specialist, I think there's a character named Polycut in that too. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if they're related.
Yeah,
but he's basically force these people into a situation where they have to steal to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And then since he's also the justice of the peace, he's like, okay, well, you all are thieves, so I'm going to put a bounty on your head.
Right.
So they all take off and go live up in the hills. And Polycut has Loco come in with
his... Yeah, hired Loco and his men to kind of come in and kind of... And the thing is, Loco isn't against killing. It's wanted dead or alive, so regardless of who it is, and Loco is a pretty vicious bastard, right? He there are some men who kind of willingly go in with him because they because they know that they, you know, their time is numbered, but Loco doesn't give a shit and will kill them like in front of their mothers. You're like, wow, okay, this is brutal. And like when you see it's Kinski, you're like, oh, this is such perfect casting.
Because he's a lunatic.
Yeah, he was known as a fucking madman because he was this prima donna actor who thought he was the bee's fucking knees. And to be honest, when you look at a good amount of his films, yes, he was a great actor.
He's fucking one of the brilliant. Best.
Yeah. And like he was a liar, a known liar, because he wrote memoirs of his life and all of it was fake. He was also, you know, he was accused by his one daughter of raping her in front of her mother, which is one of the fucking most vilest things in the world. So it's like you have this complete deranged lunatic running around. And there's some films that I love that he's in, like the alien ripoff Creature, Titan Find from the 80s, which is just a fantastic film.
Nosferatu
remake. A lot of the Werner Herzog, the six or five or six films that he worked with,
Aguirre,
yeah. Even like the really bad sequel, is it Nosferatu the Vampire, which was an Italian sequel to Werner Herzog's Nosferatu. Is a terrible fucking film, but he's fantastic in it.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
It's a bizarre film. It's like Nosferatu in Venice, it's an Italian sequel to Herzog's film. It's fucking bizarre.
Oh yeah,
I think Donald Pleasence pops up in the film too.
Oh sweet.
Yeah. So you get introduced to this, that there's this plight within the town. There are these people hiding out in the woods, you know, in the hills of around this area. And there are bounty killers pretty much coming and trying to get as many as they can. And they're working with the bank and the Justice of the Peace, who is the same man, to pretty much, you know, clear out, because the bank can now control all this land and kind of do whatever the hell it wants.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so so you have Frank Wool's character kind of is marked as a sheriff and is made to kind of make the go to the town and kind of ease things, because this is a little too overbearing, even though he feels like I think I need more people than just me to kind of handle this. Like I love that introduction when he's in the
governor's office.
Yeah, he's in the office and they're kind of, you're deputizing him. He's like, I don't know if, like, I mean, I'll go do it. Like, I don't know if I think I might need more than just me to do this. Because it's kind of rampant to the point where they have to, like, the last sheriff has kind of either left or disappeared or been killed. And it's like, yeah, we got this guy. And he comes off as a strong character. Like, when we first meet him.
Yeah. Under any other circumstances, he would be a competent sheriff. His heart's right. In the right place. Mm-hmm. He's a noble character.
Yep.
He wants to do the right thing. And basically, he's just there to kind of keep the peace until the amnesty can go through. I guess they're waiting on people to vote on what amnesty. I don't know why the governor didn't just
put into law. Yeah, fuck.
Yeah, but maybe the Italians didn't understand how, you know, our government, you know, governors can pardon people.
Right.
But yeah, so there's going to be amnesty declared for these people, and his job is to just keep the peace until that mm-hmm. happens.
Yes.
And then the people can come back out of the mountains. Everybody will be happy. They'll run and then the bounty hunters won't have anybody to, you know, they won't have any way of making money, so they'll move mm-hmm. on. So it's just all he has to do is bide his time and keep the peace.
But yes.
Instead, you have Loco, who is going around just cold-blooded murder. You know, it's you know, more alive or dead or alive. Well, you forget about the alive thing, because and all these people are even willing to, like, voluntarily come out of the mountains thinking they're going to get a fair trial.
Yeah.
But no, the second they show their faces, you know, Kinski guns them down, or one of his men guns them down.
Mm.
So they manage to get Silence to come in, and Silence kind of has this reputation of, you know, being, you know, the guy that stands up for the little guy, but for a price.
Right. And he has a unique way of doing it.
Yeah, he goads people into drawing on him.
Yeah.
And since he is so much faster, and he has the an unusual gun for a Western. It's a Mauser C96, I believe it is.
Uh-huh.
But it's a semi-automatic, you know, pistol with a magazine, and it's uh-huh. not like he doesn't have a six gun like everybody else.
Yeah.
And one of the things he'll do, if you draw on him, he'll kill you.
Uh-huh.
But if, you know, you might be a threat in the future, then what he'll do is shoot your thumbs off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is ironic, because if you had his gun, you wouldn't need your thumb, because it's semi-automatic.
Uh-huh.
But it's freaking cool, because, you know, when we talk about Django being a violent movie, this one ups that.
Yeah.
Not in terms of a body count, but you actually see the thumb come off the hand, and right, blood spurting. And when people get, I mean, it's more pushing towards the Peckinpah level of, you know, squibs and blood pouring out of people's heads. Uh-huh. It's freaking awesome.
And you can, and the thing is, we can introduce this character who is just kind of roaming. He's not actually really headed towards the town, but it just kind of becomes the place he ends up at. Right. And because of certain things, like with
and it's just like sheer coincidence that
because he's
the one that screwed up his throat and killed his family.
Screwed up the throat is a nice way to say it. Yes,
yeah.
He did the same thing to his father 20 something years ago or 30 something years ago. It doesn't really spend, you know, when Silence was a young boy, his father was put in the same predicament. And instead of just letting him kind of, you know, surrender like he was going to, he has a bunch of, you know, our banker has a bunch of bounty hunters come in and kill him and then kill his mother. Mm-hmm. And the banker is such a little fucking, you know, sneak about this. And he's like, what about the boy? And he's like, oh, I'll make sure that never happens.
He'll never talk to you.
Because there's some great scenes. Like, there's a scene where they're on the stagecoach with him and Wolf are on the stagecoach, and Wolf is just going on and on and on and on. And you can definitely tell that, like, he's listening to him, but he can't respond to him. And Wolf's just like, just doesn't pay attention, and the guy's not responding to him. It's like, okay, we got this kind of, you know, funny character. This is after he's already lost the horse to the settlers. And like, you know, he kind of just, you know, he's telling him where he's headed and whatnot.
He's a friendly guy. He's just making conversation, and he's on the same. The three men that are on the coach are Loco, the sheriff, Frank, played by Frank Wolf, and Silence.
Yeah.
And Silence is just sitting there staring at him. And, you know, Kinski knows he's going to have to go up against Silence at some point.
At some point. And you can definitely tell that Wolf,
the sheriff, Wolf can't, doesn't realize that he's going to get caught in the middle of all this bullshit.
Yeah.
And he's kind of, there's tension, a little bit of tension between him and Silence, because Silence is just kind of like, you know, looking at him.
Right.
And he's already kind of, he knows Kinski is a bounty hunter, because he, you know, has his dead bodies with him when he catches the stagecoach.
And Kinski knows who Silence is.
Like, yeah, all three of them are right there. And it's, and of course, you cannot deny that this was the inspiration for the first act of Hateful Eight.
Sure, definitely.
I mean, it's absolutely, I mean, even some of the shots are identical.
Yeah, definitely. But,
yeah, and you get that with Tarantino. He's going to borrow from his favorite movies, and Django and Great Silence are two of his favorite movies.
And the only reason Silence kind of takes on the mantle of kind of helping anything is Valletta's Pauline. Her husband is killed in front of her because of the bounty killers, and she sends a letter out to him. So we kind of find out that she's the one who kind of called for him. And we get a really interesting scene, because Pauline's husband is killed by Charlie, one of Loco's men. And like later in the, like a little bit later, we get the scene where Silence is in this kind of like, I guess kind of like, it's a bar, kind of an inn type of thing, trying to stay warm. And Charlie kind of pulls his gun on him and like, you know, cocks it, and pretty much as he turns around, Silence goes and shoots him dead. And there are kind of, you know, people, or I guess who are kind of sheriffs or kind of some kind of an ability to kind of, you know, arrest people. And they're like, well, yeah, we can't really do it.
The old sheriff was there.
Yeah, our hands are tied because it's like...
It was self-defense. We all saw it.
Yeah. And he deliberately does this. Like, you have a man who can't speak a word, and it just seems like people don't like a man who doesn't respond to them in the Wild, Wild West, which I guess makes sense. So he kind of, you know, with that kind of taunt, is like, well, I can't talk back, so I'm just going to stay silent. You can just continue talking and talking and getting more and more mad at me, and then you're going to pull your gun on you, and you're going to kill yourself, practically. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, it's unique. And I like the fact that it is a Mauser, and the fact that his gun case, which is this kind of wooden case, which has this kind of like a ricochet kind of ability to kind of pop off when he can pull the gun out. It also can be used as like a shoulder mount when he has to actually use it for target practice and whatnot.
The holster is made out of wood, and then you can take it out and turn it around and clip it to the back of the grip, and it becomes a shoulder stock. So it's a pretty neat weapon. It was state of the art for, you know, I think it came out in 1896, and then
right
place in 1898.
Yeah. And another thing you have to remember with this film is that we're in the snow, right? And you get this very early on in the film with Frank Wolf's character, because he's kind of out of his depth automatically when he's, you know, as he's trying to ride this horse through the snow, and the horse kind of gives up on him, and you have the settlers tackle him, and he pulls his gun, and they're like, well, you're not going to do anything with that because it's frozen solid. And and you can see how the settlers have figured this out, and they bury their guns within their layers of clothing to keep their guns warm so they can actually use them if they have to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like he's the only one out of everyone who seems to understand that, like, you know, that was a bad faux pas, I guess you can say. He kind of does better with his weapons later in the film. So you have Silence come in. Silence takes on the role of what's going on. You find out why he can't talk. And then it becomes this kind of revenge tale of Silence taking on this bounty for, you know, to get revenge on Valletta's, Pauline's husband's death. You know, there's twists and turns, like I said. Like, you find out that the banker and the justice of the peace is also the same man who caused the death of Silence's parents. So it kind of inadvertently works towards his favor that if he can get the man who caused the death of his parents. You have the unrepressible loco who's at odds ends with this sheriff, which I find it fun when Frank Wolf finally gets into town and Loco has brought bodies with him because they both take the same coach. And he's like, well, you know, I'll take care of it tomorrow. He's like, hey, well, maybe you can think about paying me to get this done. I mean, my job is done. This is it. This is the justice of peace. And he and the sheriff automatically realizes that what's going on here. He realizes that the justice of the peace and the banker are working with the bounty killers to kind of cause this amount of death and bloodshed. So these people can stay fed and wealthy, and then he can take over the land when it's all like, you know, all these people are gone. Right. So they're both working on the same end. And he's like, well, I have to do investigations on this. I can't just be like, I can't just be clearing, just giving you the money for these things. I have to, what the hell is going on here? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to investigate. And he knows he's going to have to give up the money. He's pretty much sure that,
that they're working together in some way.
And Loco has killed all these people.
Yeah.
But he's still kind of like, okay, you know, I'm just trying to stall. And he's looking for ways, doing the best he can, kind of, interfere with Loco and Polycut's plans.
Yeah.
And to the point, even to the extent where he arrests Loco. I don't remember what he arrested him for. Yeah. But then he confiscates the money again after he had, he'd done his investigation, gave him the money, and then, you know, Loco, he finds mages to find some reason to, you know, confiscate the money again and throw Loco in jail.
Mm-hmm.
But Loco, whereas Silence has this kind of, the way he skirts the law is only killing in self-defense. Mm-hmm. When he goes after Loco, he walks into the bar and throws his cigar and
Yeah, the Loco's little match, and then throws his cigar into the whiskey. Yeah,
yeah, and Loco, he's like, yeah, I'm not falling for that shit.
Yeah,
and he stands up and has one of his guys take his gun off of him, and he's like, hey, you can't kill me now, I'm unarmed. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, he automatically says to him, he's like, I know who you are, I know your whole gimmick, and it's like, you're not going to get me that easy. And his men are pretty easy to get, because he's just like, he just taunts them a little bit and they automatically pull their guns and he just kills two of them right then and there. And like, so because it's kind of cat and mouse between Silence and Loco, and Silence has to get revenge for Pauline, and that's the man he has to ultimately get, is, you know, he has to kill Loco. And it's like, okay. And it's like, the thing is with this film, because the character doesn't speak, you have this kind of like, you have this like, it's just like in his eyes and his face and his and mannerisms is what kind of works great about it. And you have a French actor who's kind of known for being this very rugged looking man.
He reminds me of Christopher Lambert.
Yeah, in a weird way. Very younger. Yeah. And it's like, so like we talked about with Django, there's a nihilistic streak throughout that film. This film ratchets it to 100. Right. It's depressing. Marconi's score for this film is kind of really works in its favor, because you have that kind of ongoing piano theme that roams through the whole film. This kind of sad piano that he plays throughout the whole film that kind of just continues to remind us of like what's good. Like we're stuck in the snow. So we're in this cold condition. It's constantly dark because we're in those kind of months. And then you have this kind of sadness of this character who is, you know, pretty much out there to kind of get revenge. And like everybody in the film just seems so like even with the Frank Wolf character kind of being the kind of the color commentary, I guess you can say, there's some moments of him kind of levity, you know, livening up things. It doesn't really help because the film is so kind of bleak and so dark. Mm-hmm. Even to the, when you get to the very ending, the fact that like the end of that film was so bleak and dark that they forced Corbucci to make two different endings.
And have you seen those alternate endings?
Yes, I've seen. I've seen the original kind of happy ending was on the old DVDs. I remember when it first came out, and then when Film Movement put out this Blu-ray, they actually had both versions of the. You know, the one that they kind of cut it down to what it was originally.
Yeah. The like, one ending just kind of ends the movie early.
Yeah.
And like you have to kind of guess what happened. And then the other version, the other ending, like the sheriff comes back from the dead and
right, yeah.
It comes and running saves everyone, horse, yeah. And it's like very Hollywood ending.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous.
Well, like the oblivious ending is the one where it's like, before everything happens, so we'll get into this. So pretty much everything ratchets up to the very ending, where Loco pretty much is able to kind of round up all the rest of the settlers, and they bring him into this bar, and he has everyone of our characters. He's killed off the sheriff because the sheriff's arrested him for something, and he's bringing him to the next town over because it's like a federal offense or something that I forget what it was. And while he's doing this, Loco is kind of hidden a gun. And it's kind of forced the sheriff out to the middle of this frozen lake, and it shot him, and he pretty much falls into the ice and freezes to death.
Well, and see that's the thing about that scene.
Yeah,
and throughout the movie, everybody that Loco kills.
Yeah,
because he doesn't shoot the sheriff. He shoots at the sheriff's feet, and the sheriff stumbles backwards and falls on the ice. Mm-hmm. Everybody he kills in this movie,
yeah,
he has like a warrant for.
Sure.
And the one person that he does have the opportunity to murder, he doesn't murder him. He basically
makes it look like an accident. Yeah.
Yeah. Makes the guy kill himself, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got this other character in Silence who he will only kill if, you know, he can, you know, provoke somebody.
Yeah.
So there's not, for these very morally bent characters, nobody actually murders anybody. Yeah. Which you know, under the legal sense. And that's one of the things, I guess, you know, one of the big themes of this movie is what is justice versus what is legal. They're not the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of interesting, you know, dynamic between these two characters. Both of them are technically on the side of the law, but they're very different motivations, very different ways of going about things. Mm-hmm. You know, one of them's obviously a cold-blooded, they're both cold-blooded killers.
Yeah.
But they've both using loopholes to enact their, you know, killings. And so it's you know, a pretty blatant statement about, you know, the nature of the legal system and what have you. It's you know, it's much deeper than you expect from a cheap, you know, spaghetti western. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's very, very. There's a whole lot of philosophy going on.
Yeah,
and then the love interest in this movie, you know, is a black woman in 1967-68, you know, with a white man. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you know controversial, and yes. You know, he, you know, after Django, you know, again, he was, you know, had the racist character killing off the brown people, and this one you've got, you know, he's again very, it's a very progressive statement,
yeah,
that he's got going on here. And then I mean, I guess you want to go ahead and get to the talk about the ending of the movie.
Yeah, we can do that real quick. So pretty much Loco is kind of gathered up all the rest of the settlers and is kind of forcing Silence to kind of come to him. And like he's taking Pauline, he's pretty much taking everyone hostage that's still alive, and forced him into the saloon. The great thing about this film, I say with the snow, is that most of the film, a good portion of the film, is filmed in the hills and whatnot, and actual in America in the snow. And then when they cut to like where we are, like when we're back in Italy, it's all like snow. The snow is all like fucking, you know, it's all fucking soap flakes and all that shit. And it caused a big problem, like as the film progressed, because the snow, that stuff would melt and it would create mud and just make this fucking really mess. But anyway, so they kind of force Silence to kind of come to him, and Silence kind of, you know, because of his morals, he can't, you know, he can't do what he has to do, because it's like a weird clause in his own head that he can't shoot, he can't kill somebody unless they pull a gun on him. Right, which causes his downfall.
Well, by that point, he's been shot once. Mm-hmm. He's had his hand like stuck on hot coals, and burnt his gun hand is burned all to shit. So he's only got his left hand now, and can't even use his holster. He's just kind of got his gun stuck in his belt when he goes to, you know, have his big showdown with Loco.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then he gets one of Loco's men shoots him in the other hand.
Yep.
So it's kind of like a callback to Django, mm-hmm. where you've got a guy who is, you know, quicker than shit. You know he's going to win, but what do you do when you take away his hands? And you're thinking, oh well, shit. You know he's going to pull a Django. He's got a, you know, semi-automatic pistol. He's going to be able to pull this off.
Nope.
No.
Nope. No. He gets shot by Loco like a dog. And then, you know, pretty much Loco's men kill everyone else. And then kind of run off into the wilderness. And it's like,
yeah, they,
and they pretty much end like all the,
they kill Pauline when she comes to help him,
and like save him.
Yeah.
And like, tries to get the gun and she gets shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they just go in and execute everybody that's left. And
yeah, they have all the settlers kind of like tied down to the floor, like either tied or like handcuffed to the ground, to the floor, to kind of, and pretty much holding them hostage. And when, after we killed Pauline and Silence, they pretty much just massacre all the rest of them. So it's kind of like 10 people or 12 people in this kind of bar saloon. And you're like, all right. And then they just get on their fucking horses and ride off. And you're like, what the fuck?
And yeah, like, it is the absolute bleakest freaking ending.
And like I saw the two endings. Like, so you have the ending where where Frank Wolf's character comes back, somehow survives being nearly drowned in a frozen lake, and kind of saves the day, and they have this big fucking all right. And then the second ending I heard that they forced Carbucci to make, which ultimately they didn't, I don't think they used, I think they may have used the happy ending in certain releases. But this ending they kind of didn't. It may have gotten put out there, but I don't think so. Where it ends right before the big fight happens. So, right. You know, so Silence has been shot. Silence has been burned, and he's kind of laying on the ground. He's on his knees. He's already been shot in the hand. And they cut to where, like, right before Loco comes back out of the bar and has his last big reveal with, you know, with Silence, where he kills him. They pretty much just stop the film right there and put the Finn title at the very end of it. It's like, okay, that's even worse, because it leaves it completely open to, like, what the fuck happened? Did anybody win? Like, what the fuck is that? Like, you leave us completely, like, guessing, like, questioning everything. And then a number of years later, the full theatrical version of the film came out, and it's like, oh, that's fucked up. That's really just. Like, holy shit, you know, because it's like in the film, like, you feel that the character of Silence really has nowhere else to go. It seems like this is the culmination of what he's been kind of roaming the countryside for years for, is to kind of get, you know, the revenge on his parents. And he kind of works that out because the banker does get what he deserves in the film. And it's like, okay, like, and you can see that he's kind of got his thing, but like, what he's being paid for is not going to happen. He's not going to get revenge on Loco. Loco's way smarter than he is. You can ultimately feel that even though Silence is this kind of well-known gunfighter, he definitely has his, you know, his morals kind of overlap everything else in his life. And that's what fucks him, is that, like, you know, a man with morals does not help, you know, because he has to pretty much, He can't work to the level of where Loco is. And Loco's digging in the dirt and kind of really just gnarly and nasty about things. He doesn't give a shit. Right? And Silence has that moral compass that kind of ultimately causes his own death.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, like you said, it's just friggin' depressing. I mean, in the last minute, everybody you give a shit about dies. Mm-hmm. And dies in a brutal way. I mean, it's not just like, oh, he gets shot and it's bloodless. I mean, there's blood gushing from Silence's head where the bullet went in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty gnarly. And it's just one of those things. It's like the end of a Romero film, you know? It's like the world is a shitty place and everything's fucked.
Yeah.
It's fucking depressing. And what's interesting about this, I mean, because this really didn't set the world on fire, even in Europe. And over here, it did not get a release because, Clint Eastwood saw it and said, well, maybe we should do an American version of it.
Yes.
So he had 20th Century Fox buy the rights to it. And when the 20th Century Fox execs saw the movie, they were like, what the fuck did we just buy?
Right.
You can't make this movie. No. So they just stuck it on the shelf. And that's, I mean, whereas Django, you know, growing up, you could see Django every now and then, or find it on a public domain box set or some shit.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, it was like 40 years before anybody over here got to see The Great Silence, which sucks, because, I mean, it probably would have changed the way I viewed movies had I seen it, you know, in my teens or 20s rather than in my 30s or 40s.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, they did use some of the ideas. You can notice, like, in Joe Kidd, of course, takes place in the winter, and Eastwood uses the same gun. But not my favorite Clint Eastwood movie by any stretch of the imagination. No. But yeah, it's just an amazing piece of film. It's, you know, and one of the reasons, you know, I like doing the show and, you know, talking to you about these movies is, you know, the Western genre people have this impression of Westerns that they're all the same thing and it's all, you know, friggin' John Ford.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same John Wayne movie over and over again.
Right.
It's like, no, there's some incredible depth to some of these films. And even the, you know, this is a low budget throwaway movie, but it's a friggin' masterpiece. So, I mean, just absolutely love it. Anybody, if you have not seen this movie, you just got to see it. It's depressing. So maybe, you know, take your Zoloft before you watch it. But it's a great film.
Like I said, it's available pretty much everywhere you want to watch it. Film Movement put out a fantastic Blu-ray a couple years ago, which is what I watched. I don't have anything else to say about either of these films.
I think we've pretty much covered the gist of them.
Yeah.
So what are we going to do next month, my friend?
Well, that's your turn to pick. So,
all right, well, let's do something
a lighter.
Yeah. I was thinking since we missed the Halloween show, maybe we could do Tomahawk or something. But that's way fucking dark. I don't want to do that yet. Maybe we'll do that in January.
Sure.
Or February, but let's do My Name Is Nobody.
Okay, yeah, sure.
How's that sound?
Awesome, yeah.
Yeah,
awesome. All right, so since you have all the outro information, why don't you give it out?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, if you're still with us after the past, I don't even know how long we've been doing this, but all right, you can give us a call at 304-769-9006. That's 304-769-9006. Call today. Leave us a message. Tell us what you think of the show. Tell us what you think of the movies. Tell us how Sergio Corbucci changed your life. Or if you just want to type something out or send an MP3, you can send it to jafmpodcast@gmail.com.
All right. That's pretty much it, cowpokes. I hope you enjoyed this. And, all right. I don't know, fucking get back on your horses and ride. I don't know.